rich voice filled the air with the edgeless, honeyed beauty of the ancient tongue. These exceptional stanzas cannot possibly be of aid in your Sanskrit test. The scholar dismissed them sceptically. But familiarity with that particular poem enabled me on the following day to pass the Sanskrit examination. Through the discerning help Nantu had given, I also attained the minimum grade for success in all my other subjects. Father was pleased that I had kept my word and concluded my secondary school course. My gratitude sped to the Lord, whose sole guidance I perceived in my visit to Nantu's home and in my walk by the unhabitual route of the debris-filled lot. Playfully, he had given a dual expression to his timely design for my rescue. I came across the discarded book, whose author had denied God precedence in the examination halls. I could not restrain a chuckle at my own silent comment. It would only add to this fellow's confusion if I were to tell him that divine meditation among the cadavers is a shortcut to a high school diploma. In my new dignity, I was now openly planning to leave home. Together with a young friend, Jitendra Mazumdar, I decided to join a Banaras hermitage, Sri Bharat Dharma Mahamandal, and receive its spiritual discipline. A desolation fell over me one day at the thought of separation from my family. Since mother's death, my affection had grown especially tender for my two younger brothers, Sananda and Bishnu, and for Tamu, my youngest sister. I rushed to my retreat, the little attic that had witnessed so many scenes in my turbulent sadhana. After a two-hour flood of tears, I felt singularly transformed, as by some alchemical cleanser. All attachment disappeared. My resolution to seek God as the friend of friends became adamantine. I make one last plea. Father was distressed as I stood before him for his blessing. Do not forsake me and your grieving brothers and sisters. Revered Father, how can I tell my love for you? But even greater is my love for the Heavenly Father, who has given me the gift of a perfect Father on earth. Let me go, that I some day return with a more divine understanding. With reluctant parental consent, I set out to join Jitendra, already in Banaras at the hermitage. On my arrival, the young head Swami, Dayananda, greeted me cordially. Tall and thin, of thoughtful mien, he impressed me favourably. His fair face had a Buddha-like composure. I was pleased that my new home possessed an attic where I managed to spend the dawn and morning hours. The ashram members, knowing little of meditation practices, thought I should employ my whole time in organisational duties. They gave me praise for my afternoon work in their office. "Don't try to catch God so soon." This ridicule from a fellow resident accompanied one of my early departures towards the attic. I went to Dayananda, busy in his small sanctum overlooking the Ganges. "Swamiji, I don't understand what is required of me here. I am seeking direct perception of God. Without him, I cannot be satisfied with affiliation or creed or performance of good works." The orange-robed ecclesiastic gave me an affectionate pat. Staging a mock rebuke, he admonished a few nearby disciples. "Don't bother Mukunda. He will learn our ways." I politely concealed my doubt. The students left the room, not noticeably bent with their chastisement. Dayananda had further words for me. "Mukunda, I see that your father is regularly sending you money. Please return it to him. You require none here. A second injunction for your discipline concerns food. Even when you feel hunger, do not mention it." Whether famishment gleamed in my eye, I know not. That I was hungry, I knew only too well. The invariable hour for the first hermitage meal was 12 noon. I had been accustomed in my own home to a large breakfast at 9 o'clock. A 3-hour gap became daily more interminable. Gone were the Calcutta years where I could rebuke the cook for a 10-minute delay. Now I tried to control my appetite. I completed a 24-hour fast. With double zest, I awaited the following midday. Dayanandaji's train is late. We're not going to eat until he arrives. Jitendra brought me this devastating news. As a gesture of welcome to the Swami, who had been absent for 2 weeks, many delicacies were in readiness. An appetizing aroma filled the air. Nothing else offering, what could be swallowed except my pride in yesterday's fast? Lord, hasten the train. The heavenly provider, I thought, could hardly have been included in the interdiction with which Dayananda had silenced me. Divine attention was elsewhere, however. The plodding clock covered the hours. Darkness was descending as our leader entered the door. My greeting was one of sheer joy. Dayanandaji will bathe and meditate before we can serve food. Jitendra approached me again as a bird of ill omen. I was near collapse. My young stomach, new to deprivation, protested with gnawing vigour. Pictures I had seen of famine victims passed wraith-like before me. The next Banaras death from starvation is due at once in this hermitage, I thought. Impending doom was averted at 9 o'clock. Ambrosial summons. In memory, that evening meal is vivid as one of life's perfect hours. Intense absorption had not prevented me from observing that Dayananda ate absent-mindedly. He was apparently above my gross pleasures. Swamiji, weren't you hungry? Happily surfeited, I was alone with the leader in his study. Oh, yes, he said. I spent the last 4 days without food or drink. I never eat on trains, filled with the heterogeneous vibrations of worldly people. Strictly, I observe the Shastric rules for monks of my particular order. Certain problems of our organizational work lie on my mind. Tonight at home I neglected my dinner. What's the hurry? Tomorrow I make it a point to have a proper meal. He laughed merrily. Shame spread within me like a suffocation, but the past day of my torture was not easily forgotten. I ventured a further remark. Swamiji, I am puzzled about following your instruction. Suppose I never ask for food, and nobody gives me any. I should starve to death. Die, then. This alarming counsel spit the air. Die, if you must, Mukunda. Never believe that you live by the power of food and not by the power of God. He who has created every form of nourishment, he who has bestowed appetite, will inevitably see that his devotee is maintained. Do not imagine that rice sustains you, nor that money or men support you. Could they aid if the Lord withdraws your life breath? They are his instruments merely. Is it by any skill of yours that food digests in your stomach? Use the sword of your discrimination, Mukunda. Cut through the chains of agency and perceive the single cause. I found his incisive words entering some deep marrow. Gone was an age-old delusion by which bodily imperatives outwit the soul. Then and there I tasted the spirit's all-sufficiency. In how many strange cities in my later life of ceaseless travel did occasion arise to prove the serviceability of this lesson in a Banaras hermitage? The sole treasure which had accompanied me from Calcutta was the Sadhu's silver amulet, bequeathed to me by mother. Guarding it for years, I now had it carefully hidden in my ashram room. To renew my joy in the talismanic testimony, one morning I opened the locked box, the sealed covering untouched. Lo, the amulet was gone. Mournfully I tore open the envelope, and made unmistakably sure. It had vanished, in accordance with the Sadhu's prediction, into the ether whence he had summoned it. My relationship with Dayananda's followers grew steadily worse. The household was alienated, hurt by my determined aloofness. My strict adherence to meditation on the very ideal for which I had left home and all worldly ambitions called forth shallow criticism from all sides. Torn by spiritual anguish, I entered the attic one dawn, resolved to pray until an answer was vouchsafed. Merciful Mother of the Universe, teach me thyself through visions, or through a guru sent by thee? The passing hours found my sobbing pleas without response. Suddenly, I felt lifted, as though bodily, to a sphere uncircumscribed. Thy master cometh today. A divine womanly voice came from everywhere and nowhere. The supernal experience was shattered by a shout from a definite locale. A young priest, nicknamed Habu, was calling me from the downstairs kitchen. Mukunda, enough of meditation, you're needed for an errand. Another day I might have replied impatiently. Now I wiped my tear-swollen face and meekly obeyed the summons. Together, Habu and I set out for a distant marketplace in the Bengali section of Banaras. The ungentle Indian sun was not yet at zenith as we made our purchases in the bazaars. We pushed our way through the colourful medley of housewives, guides, priests, simply clad widows, dignified Brahmins, and ubiquitous holy bulls. As Habu and I moved on, I turned my head to survey a narrow, inconspicuous lane. A Christ-like man, in the ochre robes of a swami, stood motionless at the end of the lane. Instantly and anciently familiar he seemed. For a trice my gaze fed hungrily. Then doubt assailed me. You are confusing this wandering monk with someone known to you, I thought. Dreamer, walk on. After 10 minutes, I felt heavy numbness in my feet. As though turned to stone, they were unable to carry me farther. Laboriously I turned around. My feet regained normality. I faced the opposite direction. Again, the curious weight oppressed me. The saint is magnetically drawing me to him. With this thought, I heaped my parcels into the arms of Habu. He had been observing my erratic footwork with amazement, and now burst into laughter. What ails you? Are you crazy? My tumultuous emotion prevented any retort. I sped silently away. Retracing my steps as though wing-shod, I reached the narrow lane. My quick glance revealed the quiet figure, steadily gazing in my direction. A few eager steps, and I was at his feet. Guru Deva. The divine face was the one I'd seen in a thousand visions. These halcyon eyes, in a leonine head, with pointed beard and flowing locks, had oft peered through the gloom of my nocturnal reveries, holding a promise I had not fully understood. Oh, my own, you have come to me. My guru uttered the words again and again in Bengali, his voice tremulous with joy. How many years have I waited for you? We entered a oneness of silence. Words seemed the rankest superfluities. Eloquence flowed in soundless chant from the heart of master to disciple. With an antenna of irrefragable insight, I sensed that my guru knew God and would lead me to him. The obscuration of this life disappeared in a fragile dawn of prenatal memories. Dramatic time. Past, present, and future are its cycling scenes. This was not the first sun to find me at these holy feet. My hand in his, my guru led me to his temporary residence in the Rana Mahal section of the city. His athletic figure moved with firm tread. Tall, erect, about 55 at this time, he was active and vigorous as a young man. His dark eyes were large, beautiful with plumless wisdom. Slightly curly hair softened a face of striking power. Strength mingled subtly with gentleness. As we made our way to the stone balcony of a house overlooking the Ganges, he said affectionately, I shall give you my hermitages, and all I possess. Sir, I come for wisdom and God-realization. Those are your treasure troves I am after. The swift Indian twilight had dropped its half-curtain before my master spoke again. His eyes held unfathomable tenderness. I give you my unconditional love. Precious words. A quarter century elapsed before I had another auricular proof of his love. His lips were strange to ardour. Silence suited his oceanic heart. "Will you give me the same unconditional love?" He gazed at me with childlike trust. "I will love you eternally, Gurudeva." Ordinary love is selfish, darkly rooted in desires and satisfactions. Divine love is without condition, without boundary, without change. The flux of the human heart is gone forever at the transfixing touch of pure love. He added humbly, "If you ever find me falling from a state of God-realization, please promise to put my head on your lap and help to bring me back to the cosmic beloved we both worship." He rose then in the gathering darkness and guided me to an inner room. As we ate mangoes and almond sweetmeats, he unobtrusively wove into his conversation an intimate knowledge of my nature. I was awestruck at the grandeur of his wisdom, exquisitely blended with an innate humility. "Do not grieve for your amulet. It has served its purpose." Like a divine mirror, my guru apparently had caught a reflection of my whole life. "The living reality of your presence, Master, is joy beyond any symbol. It is time for a change, inasmuch as you are unhappily situated in the hermitage." I had made no references to my life. They now seemed superfluous. By his natural, unemphatic manner, I understood that he wished no astonished ejaculations at his clairvoyance. "You should go back to Calcutta. Why exclude relatives from your love of humanity?" His suggestion dismayed me. My family was predicting my return, though I had been unresponsive to many pleas by letter. "Let the young bird fly in the metaphysical skies," Ananta had remarked. "His wings will tire in the heavy atmosphere. We shall yet see him swoop toward home, fold his pinions, and humbly rest in our family nest." This discouraging simile fresh in my mind, I was determined to do no swooping in the direction of Calcutta. "Sir, I am not returning home, but I will follow you anywhere. Please give me your address and your name." "Swami Sri Yukteswar Giri. My chief hermitage is in Serampore, on Rai Ghat Lane. I am visiting my mother here for only a few days." I wondered at God's intricate play with his devotees. Serampore is but 12 miles from Calcutta. Yet in those regions I had never caught a glimpse of my guru. We had had to travel for our meeting to the ancient city of Kashi, Banaras, hallowed by memories of Lahiri Mahashai. Here too were the feet of Buddha, Shankaracharya, and many other yogi Christs had blessed the soil. "You will come to me in 4 weeks." For the first time, Sri Yukteswar's voice was stern. "Now that I have told you of my eternal affection, and have shown my happiness at finding you, you feel free to disregard my request. The next time we meet, you shall have to reawaken my interest. I won't easily accept you as a disciple. There must be complete surrender by obedience to my strict training." I remained obstinately silent. My guru quickly penetrated my difficulty. "Do you think your relatives will laugh at you?" "I will not return." "You will return. In 30 days. Never." The controversial tension, unrelieved, I bowed reverently at his feet and departed. Walking in the midnight darkness towards the hermitage, I wondered why the miraculous meeting had ended on an inharmonious note. The dual scales of Maya, that balance every joy with a grief. My young heart was not yet malleable to the transforming fingers of my guru. The next morning, I noticed increased hostility in the attitude of the hermitage members. They spiked my days with invariable rudeness. 3 weeks passed, Dayananda then left the ashram to attend a conference in Bombay. Pandemonium broke over my hapless head. Mukunda is a parasite, accepting hermitage hospitality without making proper return. Overhearing this remark, I regretted for the first time that I had obeyed the request to send back my money to father. With a heavy heart, I sought out my sole friend, Jitendra. I am leaving. Please convey my respectful regrets to Dayanandaji when he returns. I will leave also. My attempts to meditate here meet with no more favour than your own. Jitendra spoke with determination. I have met a Christ-like saint. Let us visit him in Serampore. And so the bird, prepared to swoop, perilously close to Calcutta. Chapter 11. Two Penniless Boys in Brindaban. It would serve you right if father disinherited you, Mukunda. How foolishly you're throwing away your life. An elder brother sermon was assaulting my ears. Jitendra and I, fresh from the train, a figure of speech merely, we were covered with dust, had just arrived at the home of Ananta, recently transferred from Calcutta to the ancient city of Agra. Brother was a supervising accountant for the Public Works Department of the government. You well know, Ananta, I seek my inheritance from the Heavenly Father. Money first, God can come later, who knows, life may be too long. God first, money is his slave, who can tell, life may be too short. My retort was summoned by the exigencies of the moment and held no presentiment. Alas, Ananta's life did come to an early close. Wisdom from the hermitage, I suppose. But I see you have left Benares. Ananta's eyes gleamed with satisfaction. He was yet hoping to secure my pinions in the family nest. My sojourn in Benares was not in vain. I found there everything my heart had been longing for. You may be sure it was not your pundit or his son. Ananta joined me in reminiscent laughter. He had had to admit that the Benares clairvoyant he selected had proved a short-sighted one. What are your plans, my wandering brother? Jitendra persuaded me to Agra. We shall view the beauties of the Taj Mahal here, I explained. Then we are going to my newly found guru, who has a hermitage in Serampore. Ananta hospitably arranged for our comfort. Several times during the evening I noticed his eyes fixed on me reflectively. I know that look, I thought. A plot is brewing. The denouement took place during our early breakfast. So, you feel quite independent of father's wealth? Ananta's gaze was innocent as he resumed the barbs of yesterday's conversation. I am conscious of my dependence on God. Words are cheap. Life has shielded you thus far. What a plight if you were forced to look to the invisible hand for your food and shelter. You would soon be begging on the streets. Never. I would not put faith in passers-by rather than in God. He can devise for his devotee 1,000 resources besides the begging bowl. More rhetoric. Suppose I suggest that your vaunted philosophy be put to a test in this tangible world. I would agree. Do you confine God to a speculative world? We shall see. Today you shall have opportunity either to enlarge or to confirm my own views. Ananta paused for a dramatic moment, then spoke slowly and seriously. I propose that I send you and your fellow disciple Jitendra this morning to the nearby city of Brindaban. You must not take a single rupee. You must not beg, either for food or money. You must not reveal your predicaments to anyone. You must not go without your meals. And you must not be stranded in Brindaban. If you return to my bungalow here before 12 o'clock tonight, without having broken any rule of the test, I shall be the most astonished man in Agra. I accept the challenge. No hesitation was in my words or in my heart. Grateful memories flashed of the instant beneficence, my healing of deadly cholera through an appeal to Lahiri Mahashai's picture, the playful gift of the two kites on the Lahore roof, the opportune amulet amidst my discouragement in Bareilly, the decisive message through the sadhu outside the courtyard of the pundit's house in Benares, the vision of Divine Mother and her majestic words of love, her swift heed through Master Mahashai to my trifling embarrassments, the last-minute guidance that had materialized my high school diploma, and the ultimate boon, my living master from the mist of my lifelong dreams. Never would I admit my philosophy unequal to any tussle on the world's harsh proving grounds. Your willingness does you credit. I'll escort you to the train at once, Ananta said. He turned to the open-mouthed Jitendra. You must go along, as a witness and very likely a fellow victim. Half an hour later, Jitendra and I were in possession of one-way tickets for the trip. We submitted, in a secluded corner of the station, to a search of our persons. Ananta was quickly satisfied that we were carrying no hidden hoard. Our simple dhotis concealed nothing more than was necessary. As faith invaded the serious realms of finance, my friend spoke protestingly. Ananta, give me 1 or 2 rupees as a safeguard, then I can telegraph you in case of misfortune. Jitendra! My ejaculation was sharply reproachful. I will not proceed with the test if you take any money as final security. There is something reassuring about the chink of coins, Jitendra said no more, as I regarded him sternly. Mukunda, I am not heartless. A hint of humility had crept into Ananta's voice. It may be that his conscience was smiting him, perhaps for sending 2 penniless boys to a strange city, perhaps for his own religious scepticism. If by any chance or grace you pass successfully through the Brindavan ordeal, I shall ask you to initiate me as your disciple. This promise had a certain irregularity, in keeping with the unconventional occasion. The eldest brother in an Indian family seldom bows before his juniors. He receives respect and obedience, second only to a father. But no time remained for my comment. Our train was at point of departure. Jitendra maintained a lugubrious silence as the train covered the miles. Finally he bestirred himself. Leaning over, he pinched me painfully on a tender spot. I see no sign that God is going to supply our next meal. Be quiet, doubting Thomas. The Lord is working with us. Can you also arrange that he hurry? Already I am famished, merely at the prospect before us. I left Benares to view the Taj Mausoleum, not to enter my own. Cheer up, Jitendra. Are we not to have our first glimpse of the sacred wonders of Brindaban? I am in deep joy at the thought of treading the ground hallowed by the feet of Lord Krishna. The door of our compartment opened. 2 men seated themselves. The next train stop would be the last. Young lads, do you have friends in Brindaban? The stranger opposite me was taking a surprising interest. None of your business. Rudely, I averted my gaze. You are probably flying away from your families, under the enchantment of the Stealer of Hearts. I am of devotional temperament myself. I will make it my positive duty to see that you receive food and shelter from this overpowering heat. No, sir, let us alone. You're very kind. But you're mistaken in judging us to be truants from home. No further conversation ensued. The train came to a halt. As Jitendra and I descended to the platform, our chance companions linked arms with us and summoned a horse cab. We alit before a stately hermitage, set amidst the evergreen trees of well-kept grounds. Our benefactors were evidently known here. A smiling lad led us without comment to a parlour. We were soon joined by an elderly woman of dignified bearing. Gauri Ma? The princess could not come, one of the men addressed the ashram hostess. At the last moment, their plans went awry. They send deep regrets. But we have brought 2 other guests. As soon as we met them on the train, I felt drawn to them as devotees of Lord Krishna. Goodbye, young friends. Our 2 acquaintances walked to the door. We shall meet again, if God be willing. You are welcome here. Gauri Ma smiled in motherly fashion. You could not have come on a better day. I was expecting 2 royal patrons of this hermitage. What a shame if my cooking had found none to appreciate it. The pleasant words had a surprising effect on Jitendra. He burst into tears. The prospect he had feared in Brindaban was turning out as royal entertainment. His sudden mental adjustment proved too much for him. Our hostess looked at him with curiosity, but without remark. Perhaps she was familiar with adolescent quirks. Lunch was announced. Gauri Ma led the way to a dining patio, spicy with savoury odours. She vanished into an adjoining kitchen. I had been premeditating this moment. Selecting the appropriate spot on Jitendra's body, I gave him a pinch as painful as the one he'd given me on the train. Doubting Thomas? The Lord works. In a hurry, too. The hostess re-entered with a punkah. She steadily fanned us in the oriental fashion as we squatted on ornate blanket seats. Ashram disciples passed to and fro with some 30 courses. Rather than meal, the description may only be sumptuous repast. Since arriving on this planet, Jitendra and I had never before tasted such delicacies. Dishes fit for princes indeed, honoured mother. What your royal patrons could have found more urgent than attending this banquet, I cannot imagine. You have given us a memory for a lifetime. Silenced as we were by Ananta's requirement, we could not explain to the gracious lady that our thanks held a double significance. Our sincerity at least was patent. We departed with her blessing and an attractive invitation to revisit the hermitage. The heat outdoors was merciless. My friend and I made for the shelter of a lordly kadamba tree at the ashram gate. Sharp words followed. Once again, Jitendra was beset with misgivings. A fine mess you've got me into. Our luncheon was only accidental good fortune. How can we see the sights of this city without a single paisa between us? And how on earth are you going to take me back to Ananta's place? You forget God quickly, now that your stomach is filled. My words, not bitter, were accusatory. How short is human memory for divine favours? No man lives who has not seen some of his prayers granted. I am not likely to forget my folly in venturing out with a madcap like you. Be quiet, Jitendra. The same Lord who fed us will show us Brindaban and return us to Agra. A slight young man of pleasing countenance approached at rapid pace. Halting under our tree, he bowed before me. Dear friend, you and your companion must be strangers here. Permit me to be your host and guide. It is scarcely possible for an Indian to pale, but Jitendra's face was suddenly sickly. I politely declined the offer. You are surely not banishing me. The stranger's alarm would have been comic in any other circumstances. Why not? You are my guru. His eyes sought mine trustfully. During my midday devotions, the blessed Lord Krishna appeared in a vision. He showed me two forsaken figures under this very tree. One face was yours, my master. Often have I seen it in meditation. What joy if you accept my humble services. I too am glad you have found me. Neither God nor man has forsaken us. Though I was motionless, smiling at the eager face before me, an inward obeisance cast me at the divine feet. Dear friends, will you not honour my home with a visit? You are kind, but the plan is unfeasible. Already we are guests of my brother in Agra. At least give me memories of touring Brindaban with you. I gladly consented. The young man, who said his name was Pratap Chatterjee, hailed a horse carriage. We visited Madana Mohana Temple and the other Krishna shrines. Night descended before we had finished our temple devotions. Excuse me while I get sandesh, an Indian sweetmeat. Pratap entered a shop near the railway station. Jitendra and I sauntered along the wide street, crowded now in the comparative coolness. Our friend was absent for some time, but finally returned with gifts of many sweetmeats. Please allow me to gain this religious merit. Pratap smiled pleadingly as he held out a bundle of rupee notes and two tickets, just purchased, to Agra. The reverence of my acceptance was for the invisible hand. Scoffed at by Ananta, had its bounty not far exceeded necessity? We sought out a secluded spot near the station. Pratap, I will instruct you in the Kriya of Lahiri Mahashai, the greatest yogi of modern times. His technique will be your guru. The initiation was concluded in half an hour. Kriya is your Chintamani, I told the new student. The technique, which, as you see, is simple, embodies the art of quickening man's spiritual evolution. Hindu scriptures teach that the incarnating ego requires a million years to obtain liberation from Maya. This natural period is greatly shortened through Kriya Yoga. Just as plant growth can be accelerated far beyond its normal rate, as Jagadish Chandra Bose has demonstrated, so man's psychological development also can be speeded by scientific means. Be faithful in your practice. You will approach the guru of all gurus. I am transported to find this yogic key long sought, Pratap spoke thoughtfully. Its unshackling effect on my sensory bonds will free me for higher spheres. The vision today of Lord Krishna could only mean my highest good. We sat a while in silent understanding, then walked slowly to the station. Joy was within me as I boarded the train, but this was Jitendra's day for tears. My affectionate farewell to Pratap had been punctuated by stifled sobs from both my companions. The journey once more found Jitendra in a welter of grief. Not for himself this time, but against himself. How shallow my trust! My heart has been stone. Never in future shall I doubt God's protection. Midnight was approaching. The two Cinderellas, sent forth penniless, entered Ananta's bedroom. Just as he had lightly predicted, his face was a study in astonishment. Silently, I showered a table with rupee notes. Jitendra, the truth. Ananta's tone was jocular. Has not this youngster been staging a hold-up? But as the tale was unfolded, my brother turned sober, then solemn. The law of demand and supply reaches into subtler realms than I had supposed. Ananta spoke with a spiritual enthusiasm never before noticeable. I understand for the first time your indifference to the vaults and vulgar accumulations of the world. Late as it was, my brother insisted that he receive Diksha into Kriya Yoga. The Guru, Mukunda, had to shoulder in one night the responsibility of two unsought disciples. Breakfast on the following day was eaten in a harmony that had been absent on the preceding morning. I smiled at Jitendra. You shall not be cheated of the Taj. Let us view it before starting for Serampore. Bidding farewell to Ananta, my friend and I were soon before the glory of Agra, the Taj Mahal. White marble, dazzling in the sun, it stands a vision of pure symmetry. The perfect setting is dark cypress, glossy lawn, and tranquil lagoon. The interior is exquisite, with lace-like carvings inlaid with semi-precious stones. Delicate wreaths and scrolls emerge intricately from marbles, brown and violet. Illumination from the dome falls on the cenotaphs of Emperor Shah Jahan and Mumtaz-e-Mahal, queen of his realm and his heart. Enough of sightseeing. I was longing for my guru. Jitendra and I were shortly travelling south by train toward Bengal. Mukunda, I have not seen my family for months. I have changed my mind. Perhaps later I shall visit your master in Serampore. My friend, who may mildly be described as vacillating in temperament, left me in Calcutta. By local train, I soon reached Serampore, 12 miles to the north. A throb of wonderment stole over me as I realized that 28 days had elapsed since the Banaras meeting with my guru. You will come to me in 4 weeks. Here I was, heart pounding, standing within his courtyard on quiet Rai Ghat Lane. I entered for the first time the hermitage where I was to spend the best part of the next 10 years with India's Gyan Avatar, incarnation of wisdom. Chapter 12. Years in My Master's Hermitage. You have come. Sri Yukteswar greeted me from a tiger skin on the floor of a balconied sitting room. His voice was cold, his manner unemotional. Yes, dear master, I'm here to follow you. Kneeling, I touched his feet.
How can that be?
You ignore my wishes. No longer, Guruji. Your wish shall be my law.
That's better. Now I can assume responsibility for your life.
I willingly transfer the burden, master.
My first request, then, is that you return home to your family. I want you to enter college in Calcutta. Your education should be continued.
Very well, sir. I hid my consternation. Would importunate books pursue me down the years? First father, now Sri Yukteswar.
Some day you will go to the West. Its people will be more receptive to India's ancient wisdom if the strange Hindu teacher has a university degree.
You know best, Guruji. My gloom departed. The reference to the West I found puzzling, remote, but my opportunity to please Master by obedience was vitally immediate.
You'll be near in Calcutta. Come here whenever you find time. Every day, if possible, Master, gratefully, I accept your authority in every detail of my life.
On one condition.
Yes?
That you promise to reveal God to me.
An hour-long verbal tussle ensued. A master's word cannot be falsified. It is not lightly given. The implications in the pledge open out vast metaphysical vistas. A guru must be on intimate terms, indeed, with the Creator, before he can obligate him to appear. I sensed Sri Yukteswar's divine unity, and was determined, as his disciple, to press my advantage.
You are of exacting disposition.
Then Master's consent rang out with compassionate finality.
Let your wish be my wish.
A lifelong shadow lifted from my heart. The vague search, hither and yon, was over. I had found eternal shelter in a true guru.
Come, I will show you the hermitage.
Master rose from his tiger mat. In glancing about, I noticed on a wall a picture that was garlanded with a spray of jasmine.
Lahiri Mahashai,
I said in astonishment.
Yes, my divine guru. Sri Yukteswar's tone was reverently vibrant. Greater he was, as man and yogi, than any other teacher whose life came within the range of my investigations. Silently, I bowed before the familiar picture. Soul homage sped to the peerless master who, blessing my infancy, had guided my steps to this hour. Led by my guru, I strolled about the house and its grounds. Large, ancient, and well-built, the massive pillared hermitage surrounded a courtyard. Outer walls were moss-covered. Pigeons fluttered over the flat grey roof, unceremoniously sharing the ashram quarters. A rear garden was pleasant with jackfruit, mango, and plantain trees. Balustraded balconies of upper rooms in the two-storied building faced the courtyard from three sides. A spacious ground-floor hall, with high ceilings supported by colonnades, was used, Master said, chiefly during the annual festivities of Durga Puja. A narrow stairway led to Sri Yukteswar's sitting room, whose small balcony overlooked the street. The ashram was plainly furnished. Everything was simple, clean, and utilitarian. Several Western-style chairs, benches, and tables were in evidence. Master invited me to stay overnight. A supper of vegetable curry was served by two young disciples who were receiving hermitage training.
Guruji, please, tell me something of your life.
I was squatting on a straw mat near his tiger skin. The friendly stars were very close, it seemed, beyond the balcony. My family name was Priya Nath Karar.
I was born here in Serampore, where father was a wealthy businessman. He left me this ancestral mansion, now my hermitage. My formal schooling was little. I found it slow and shallow. In early manhood, I undertook the responsibilities of a householder and have one daughter, now married. My middle life was blessed with the guidance of Lahiri Mahashai. After my wife died, I joined the Swami order and received the new name of Sri Yukteswar Giri. Such are my simple annals. Master smiled at my eager face. Like all biographical sketches, his words had given the outward facts without revealing the inner man. Guruji, I would like to hear some stories of your childhood.
I will tell you a few, each one with a moral. Sri Yukteswar's eyes twinkled with his warning.
My mother once tried to frighten me with an appalling story of a ghost in a dark chamber. I went there immediately and expressed my disappointment at having missed the ghost. Mother never told me another horrid tale. Moral, look fear in the face, and it will cease to trouble you. Another early memory is my wish for an ugly dog belonging to a neighbour. I kept my household in turmoil for weeks to get that dog. My ears were deaf to offers of pets with more prepossessing appearance. Moral, attachment is blinding. It lends an imaginary halo of attractiveness to the object of desire. A third story concerns the plasticity of the youthful mind. I heard my mother remark occasionally, "A man who accepts a job under anyone is a slave." That impression became so indelibly fixed that even after my marriage I refused all positions. I met expenses by investing my family endowment in land. Moral, good and positive suggestions should instruct the sensitive ears of children. Their early ideas long remain sharply etched. Master fell into tranquil silence. Around midnight, he led me to a narrow cot. Sleep was sound and sweet the first night under my guru's roof. Sri Yukteswar chose the following morning to grant me his Kriya Yoga initiation. The technique I had already received from two disciples of Lahiri Mahashai, father and my tutor, Swami Kabalananda. But Master possessed a transforming power. At his touch, a great light broke upon my being, like the glory of countless suns blazing together. A flood of ineffable bliss overwhelmed my heart to an innermost core. It was late in the afternoon of the following day before I could bring myself to leave the hermitage. "You will return in 30 days." As I entered the door of my Calcutta home, the fulfillment of Master's prediction entered with me. None of my relatives made the pointed remarks I'd feared about the reappearance of the soaring bird. I climbed to my little attic and bestowed affectionate glances, as though on a living presence. "You have witnessed my meditations and the tears and storms of my sadhana. Now I have reached the harbour of my divine teacher. Son, I am happy for us both." Father and I sat together in the evening calm. "You have found your guru, as in miraculous fashion I once found my own. The holy hand of Lahiri Mahashai is guarding our lives. Your master has proved to be no inaccessible Himalayan saint, but one nearby. My prayers have been answered. In your search for God, you have not been permanently removed from my sight." Father was also pleased that my formal studies would be resumed. He made suitable arrangements. I was enrolled the following day at nearby Scottish Church College in Calcutta. Happy months sped by. My readers have doubtless made the perspicacious surmise that I was little seen in the college classrooms. The Serampore Hermitage held a lure too irresistible. Master accepted my constant presence without comment. To my relief, he seldom referred to the halls of learning. Though it was plain to all that I was never cut out for a scholar, I managed to attain minimum passing grades from time to time. Daily life at the ashram flowed smoothly, infrequently varied. My guru awoke before dawn. Lying down or sometimes sitting on the bed, he entered a state of samadhi. It was simplicity itself to discover when master had awakened. Abrupt halt of stupendous snores. A sigh or two, perhaps a bodily movement. Then a soundless state of breathlessness. He was in deep yogic joy. Breakfast did not follow. First came a long walk by the Ganges. Those morning strolls with my guru, how real and vivid still! In the easy resurrection of memory, I often find myself at his side. The early sun is warming the river. His voice rings out, rich with the authenticity of wisdom. A bath, then the midday meal. Its preparation, according to Master's daily directions, had been the careful task of young disciples. My guru was a vegetarian. Before embracing monkhood, however, he had eaten eggs and fish. His advice to students was to follow any simple diet which proved suited to one's constitution. Master ate little, often rice, coloured with turmeric or juice of beets or spinach, and lightly sprinkled with buffalo ghee or melted butter. Another day he might have lentil dal or chana curry with vegetables. For dessert, mangoes or oranges with rice pudding or jackfruit juice. Visitors appeared in the afternoons. A steady stream poured from the world into the tranquil hermitage. My guru treated all guests with courtesy and kindness. A master, one who has realized himself as the omnipresent soul, not the body or the ego, perceives in all men a striking similarity. The impartiality of saints is rooted in wisdom. They are no longer influenced by the alternating faces of Maya, no longer subject to the likes and dislikes that confuse the judgment of unenlightened men. Sri Yukteswar showed no special consideration to those who were powerful, rich, or accomplished. Neither did he slight others for their poverty or illiteracy. He would listen respectfully to words of truth from a child, and on occasion would openly ignore a conceited pundit. 8 o'clock was the supper hour, and sometimes found lingering guests. My guru would not excuse himself to eat alone. None left his ashram hungry or dissatisfied. Sri Yukteswar was never at a loss, never dismayed by unexpected visitors. Under his resourceful directions to the disciples, scanty food would emerge a banquet. Yet he was economical. His modest funds went far. "Be comfortable within your purse," he often said. "Extravagance will bring you discomfort." Whether in the details of hermitage entertainment, or of building and repair work, or of other practical concerns, Master manifested the originality of a creative spirit. Quiet evening hours often brought one of my guru's discourses, treasures against time. His every utterance was chiselled by wisdom. A sublime self-assurance marked his mode of expression. It was unique. He spoke as none other in my experience ever spoke. His thoughts were weighed in a delicate balance of discrimination before he permitted them the outward garb of speech. The essence of truth, all-pervasive, even with a physiological aspect, came from him like a fragrant exudation of the soul. I was conscious always that I was in the presence of a living manifestation of God. The weight of his divinity automatically bowed my head before him. If guests detected that Sri Yukteswar was becoming engrossed with the infinite, he quickly engaged them in conversation. He was incapable of striking a pose or of flaunting his inner withdrawal. Always one with the Lord, he needed no separate time for communion. A self-realized master has already left behind the stepping stone of meditation. The flower falls when the fruit appears. But saints often cling to spiritual forms in order to set an example for disciples. As midnight approached, my guru might fall into a doze with the naturalness of a child. There was no fuss about bedding. He often lay down, without even a pillow, on a narrow davenport, which was the background for his customary tiger-skin seat. A night-long philosophical discussion was not rare. Any disciple could summon it by intensity of interest. I felt no tiredness then, no desire for sleep. Master's living words were sufficient. "Oh, it is dawn. Let us walk by the Ganges." So ended many of my periods of nocturnal edification. My early months with Sri Yukteswar culminated in a useful lesson. how to outwit a mosquito. At home, my family always used protective curtains at night. I was dismayed to discover that in the Serampore Hermitage, this prudent custom was honoured in the breach. Yet the insects were in full residence. I was bitten from head to foot. My guru took pity on me. "Buy yourself a curtain, and also one for me," he laughed and added. "If you buy only one for yourself, all mosquitoes will concentrate on me." I was more than thankful to comply. On every night that I spent in Serampore, my guru would ask me to arrange the bedtime curtains. One night, when a cloud of mosquitoes surrounded us, Master failed to issue his usual instructions. I listened nervously to the anticipatory hum of the insects. Getting into bed, I threw a propitiatory prayer in their general direction. A half hour later, I coughed pretentiously to attract my guru's attention. I thought I would go mad with the bites, and especially the singing drone as the mosquitoes celebrated bloodthirsty rites. No responsive stir from Master. I approached him cautiously. He was not breathing. This was my first close observation of him in the yogic trance. It filled me with fright. His heart must have failed. I placed a mirror under his nose. No breath vapour appeared. To make doubly certain, for minutes I closed his mouth and nostrils with my fingers. His body was cold and motionless. In a daze, I turned towards the door to summon help. "So, a budding experimentalist. My poor nose." Master's voice was shaky with laughter. "Why don't you go to bed? Is the whole world going to change for you? Change yourself. Be rid of the mosquito consciousness." Meekly, I returned to bed. Not one insect ventured near. I realized that my guru had previously agreed to the curtains only to please me. He had had no fear of mosquitoes. By yogic power, he could prevent them from biting him, or, if he chose, he could escape to an inner invulnerability. He was giving me a demonstration, I thought. That is the yogic state I must strive to attain. A true yogi is able to pass into and maintain the superconscious state, regardless of multitudinous distractions never absent from this earth, the buzz of insects, the pervasive glare of daylight. In the first state of samadhi, sabikalpa, the devotee shuts off all sensory testimony of the outer world. He is rewarded then by sounds and scenes of inner realms fairer than the pristine Eden. The instructive mosquitoes served for another early lesson in the ashram. It was the gentle hour of dusk. My guru was matchlessly interpreting the ancient texts. At his feet, I was in perfect peace. A rude mosquito entered the idol and competed for my attention. As it dug a poisonous hypodermic needle into my thigh, I automatically raised an avenging hand. Reprieve from impending execution. An opportune memory had come to me of Patanjali's aphorism on ahimsa, harmlessness. In the presence of a man perfected in ahimsa, non-violence, enmity in any creature does not arise. "Why didn't you finish the job?" "Master, do you advocate taking life?" "No, but in your mind, you had already struck the death blow." "I don't understand." By ahimsa, Patanjali meant removal of the desire to kill. Sri Yukteswar had found my mental processes an open book. This world is inconveniently arranged for a literal practice of ahimsa. Man may be compelled to exterminate harmful creatures. He is not under a similar compulsion to feel anger or animosity. All forms of life have an equal right to the air of Maya. The saint who uncovers the secret of creation will be in harmony with nature's countless bewildering expressions. All men may understand this truth by overcoming the passion for destruction. Guruji, should one offer himself a sacrifice, rather than kill a wild beast? No. Man's body is precious. It has the highest evolutionary value because of unique brain and spinal centers. These enable the advanced devotee fully to grasp and express the loftiest aspects of divinity. No lower form is so equipped. It is true that a man incurs the debt of a minor sin if he is forced to kill an animal or any other living thing. But the holy Shastras teach that wanton loss of a human body is a serious transgression against the karmic law.